buy some Girl Scout cookies. Which kind of makes sense. It's now 1 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. But I don't, you know, I don't buy Girl Scout cookies anymore. Because one time this girl knocked on my door, not dressed as a Girl Scout, but she had the paper with her.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, do you want to buy some Girl Scout cookies? And I'm like, I don't have any money right now. And I was like, but I might be able to, buy some tomorrow. And she's like, look, if you don't want to buy any Girl Scout cookies, you can just say no. And this girl was like 9. And I'm like, no, that's not it. I just don't have any cash on me right now. I really do want to buy some Girl Scout cookies. Come back tomorrow. She's like, really, if you don't want to buy any, just say no. And I'm like, no, I do. So I don't have any money. Come back tomorrow. So she came back tomorrow. I ordered a couple boxes of Thin Mints and maybe one of those peanut butter, chocolate, cookies. And I paid for them. You got to pay up front. Never came through. Never showed back up. I got burnt by a Girl Scout who tried to guilt trip me. I mean, it was just like, it's okay.
Look, buddy, if you don't want to buy them.
Yeah, just tell me no. Don't dick me around a little bit, okay? I'm a Girl Scout. I got stuff to do. It's the second reference of a dicking around that I've done today. And I shouldn't do that. I shouldn't.
Yeah.
Use that in the same sentence as a Girl Scout. I think that might... I might have crossed the line.
You might be on a list now.
I'd like to apologize to the Girl Scouts of America.
But, if the Girl Scouts of America were really right on, they would come up with some, better all-natural cookies. Have you read the ingredients on those things? I happened to read some not that long ago.
As you were eating them, you're like, these are full of poison.
Partially hydrogenated soybean oil.
Man, that tastes delicious. It's really bad for my arteries, however.
Maybe if I put them in the freezer for a little bit.
Do you think, are Girl Scouts right on? No. Neither are Boy Scouts. I mean, I guess the Boy Scouts are becoming more right on. But Girl Scouts, they don't...
Are they?
Well, Boy Scouts now let people who are gay be Boy Scouts. They used to not. And I don't think Les's can be Girl Scouts yet.
Well, I don't think it's come to the table yet, has it?
I mean, because personally, I think lesbianism is more right on than homosexuality. That's just my personal opinion.
Really?
Yeah. And I would like to see the Girl Scouts catch up.
Yeah.
And just embrace each other. I'd like to see that. But not like that, It's a difference thing. But, we're all changing. It's like those that legislation that they wanted to pass in Kansas that you would not as a business have to participate in gay weddings if you didn't want to. I mean this is what the Kansas House Assembly spends their time doing.
I did look into that. They apparently
having like a perverted fascination with, gay people.
But apparently, Kansas wasn't trailblazing in any way. They were following in the footsteps of Arizona,
I think New Mexico, Washington. I mean, but these are not necessarily legislation that's going on, but could be lawsuits that are taking place with people who are just being just ridiculous. Cake decorators and florists. Can you imagine a florist going, oh, no, I'm not going to make a floral arrangement for two men getting married. That's gay. You're a florist. I mean, stop being so judgmental. You decorate cakes for a living.
And also, too, if
you just break off the bride and put two grooms together and get over it.
I mean, if you're a gay couple, I mean, I would say that, it doesn't matter if you're male or female. I would say that Arizona is probably a bad place to live just in general.
But that's not true. There is Palm Springs is a mecca for lesbians.
That's in California, I believe, is it not?
Is it? I don't know. It is. All right, so it's close, though. So. It's close. All right, 816-931-5534, 931-KKFI. But before we go to the phones, I do remember the story from years ago where there was a neo-Nazi family. Like, they literally named their first son Adolf. And their daughter, Ava Gardner's or not Ava Braun or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they were celebrating one of their little Nazi children's birthdays, and they needed to get a cake. And they of course wanted to have a swastika on their cake. And so they called the local, you know, grocery store, the Thriftway or the, you know, Swanson's or whatever, to get this special request. And they're like, no.
It's probably a Winn-Dixie.
Exactly. Winn-Dixie said, we're not going to do that. So they had to keep making phone calls to figure out who would decorate the cake. Walmart was more than happy to put a swastika on a cake. Walmart, however, would probably balk at the idea of, you know, putting two grooms or two brides on a cake. All right, 816-931-5534, 931-KKFI, you're on the radio.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's so fun to sit you correct in so many things. The Girl Scouts, for your information, have never, ever, ever had a policy against lesbians or young girls who happen to be lesbian or lesbian leaders. So that you're totally off base. And the Boy Scouts, the big issue was like, my God, the Girl Scouts have never had this kind of malarkey. And so that did a lot, I think, too. I don't know that it did a lot, but it was a big argument about the Boy Scouts
right.
dropping some of their restrictions. Then another thing about I can't remember what I initially called you about. Notching up these things about, yeah, Palm Springs. Give me a break, buddy. That's in the deep south of California. And, I'll tell you, there was a...
Dave, you're, like, foaming at the mouth, man. You're like, way
no,
too excited.
No, I'm not.
This.
Just listen. You know I have difficulty.
No, you're just like, it's like you're sitting at home, you're like, Ben said this, so I'll call up and say that.
No, it is so not. Excited. But I was going to tell you, there's also a gay mayor of Tempe, Arizona, for like 8 years. It's been a few years, probably close to a decade since he
sure.
went out of office. But there's exceptions to every rule.
Well, great.
And so don't ever think that. But, yeah, the old Girl Scout cookies, I can't get into those. It's just not a good use of our money.
All right. Well, Dave, we appreciate your phone call.
Just keeping you clear.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much. Very important that we stay clear on those issues. That Girl Scouts do love lesbians, which I'm relieved to hear. And Palm Springs is definitely in California. So
that's true.
That's good. Did you look that up? Did you Wikipedia that?
I already knew that.
Oh, okay. You knew that by heart?
I've driven through there.
But it's the part of California that's kind of similar to Arizona, right?
There are, it's on the other side of Joshua Tree.
Yeah. So it's close.
Big cactuses that look like this.
Right, exactly.
For all you people on the radio, looks just like this.
Just like that. 9 minutes after 1, 816-931-5534. It's 931-KKFI.
Am I making this up, or are the Cub Scouts of America based here in Kansas City?
Cub Scouts? Those are Boy Scouts, aren't they?
Boy Scouts. What's the difference?
Age?
Yeah. The same company, though, or the same organization.
Yeah, I think they call, you know, it's called Boy Scouts, but Cub Scouts are just, you know.
Cub Scouts, and then you become a Weeblo, and yeah. then you, yeah.
I don't know what happens after that.
You go into politics.
816-931-5534. 931-KKFI, you're on the radio.
No, this is Russ checking in from downtown.
Why aren't you in the Ukraine right now, Russ? Is your wife over there?
Actually, she would like to go. he's been watching it day and night through internet feeds about what's going on, but no, she's still here in the United States.
So does she think it's a conspiracy?
Well,
in that the protesters who are pro-Europe, who are making the fuss over there, are kind of, you know, what do they say, astroturfed, color revolutions being fabricated?
Well, she knows the links between George Soros and the NGOs and so forth that with Hillary Clinton that got involved last time. And what you know, they're obviously involved again through NGOs and so forth, but
Why was Viktor Yushchenko, the great hero of the Orange Revolution, why was he kind of trivialized and put on the outside of the Ukrainian political scene? Do you know why? I'm confused as to that. I'm asking you. I don't know.
Well, I mean, obviously, I'm no expert either, but even with my wife. But no, I mean, I'll just give you a quick rundown. I mean, you know, you've heard the term of oligarchs.
Sure.
But, and people here, of course, like to make out that the Koch brothers are oligarchs, but I don't quite equate the two. I mean, there may be some billionaires here that would like to be in the same category as oligarchs in Ukraine or in Russia, but they have a lot more power and influence in the governments. And that's one reason why the people are out protesting. Like the mayor, or not the mayor, Yanushenko, the president, I don't know if you saw his little second house where he had his own private zoo.
Yeah, I didn't see what that house looked like, but Robin Leach was there with the film crew, that kind of thing.
Well, what's interesting is I don't know what the yearly income is for the president there, but it's not you know, a huge amount of money. But the house was worth about $4 million or so, and
right.
I mean, it's unfortunately when the Soviet Union fell apart. You may remember when U.S. government sent over so-called experts on how, you know, turn your economy into a replica of the U.S. And that's when all hell broke loose with the oligarchs taking over. Or, you know, vulture capitalism, which basically what's happened in Russia as well. But when Ukraine got its independence back, or got its, you know, whatever back, there were so many factories and so forth that closed. You know, tens of thousands of people were laid off, and you had wealthy people run in and buy up the same companies, pennies on the dollar.
Sure.
So, right. You know, I mean, that's what basically that's what happened there. That you have just an inordinate amount of power and a handful of people. So the corruption in the system is, you know, I mean, we have corruption here, obviously, but it's not quite the same level as it is there.
Well, so, I think there's something ingrained, the level of corruption that goes back to the, you know, Soviet times as well. Where, you know, clearly being a member of the Communist Party allowed you to be corrupt, gave you
certain
privileges that other folks didn't have. And now, of course, the nature of the vulture capitalism and the oligarchies have just made that exponential, I'm sure. But what's your personal opinion as far as, I mean, these pro-European youth protesters? I mean, is this fabricated or not? Is this real? Is this?
Well, it's from her perspective. You know, she's from a city in western Ukraine, which, you know, has more aspirations. You know, they consider themselves
Europe.
More European,
right.
And you know, they want closer ties to Western Europe or to become part of the EU. But part of that is economic.
Sure, I'm sure.
I mean, once you become a member of the EU, you can travel to the EU and find work and so forth without
right.
so many restrictions. But the biggest fear that she has, along with many other Ukrainians, is that the country is going to be divided in two.
Right.
It's going to split. You know.
I mean, it seems
east
like the
west.
Country is divided into two. You're just saying that it would be divided politically into two.
Well, not just that, but it could actually split into two countries.
Oh no, that's what I mean. I mean, it seems
they
already seem incredibly divided. It's just, will that happen, you know, on a map?
Well, right, but that could be, you know. What's interesting to me is that, I mean, obviously I'm a low dog here, but that our own elites here, they seem to be itching to get involved as well. Our government here, and what people are afraid of is that it's going to turn into another Cold War situation,
right,
where almost by default, because the eastern part of Ukraine, that's where the president fled to, that, you know, they're going to have stronger and stronger links to Russia, and it may actually just become another, you know, province of Russia, or they might actually annex it. So, because there's a huge naval base that's still there by the Crimean Sea,
right,
or by the Black Sea. There's a huge Russian military base there. So, no, she.
Well,
no,
I mean, it's clear. It's pretty clear that Russia is exerting a sphere of influence over the former Soviet republics. I mean, there's no question about that. There's no question that America has a vested interest in trying to control, you know, the Central Asian natural resources. And to do that means you have to, you have to divide Russia's power. You can't deal with Russia in its own backyard if it's exerting itself. So there's a lot of things at play here. And, you know, a Cold War type scenario, it certainly seems like you could make those parallels.
Well, you know, the thing about it is that people don't realize that Ukraine is the largest country in Europe.
Sure. And most people don't realize Ukraine is a country in Europe.
Well, right, but what I'm saying is it's also been historically the breadbasket of Europe. So it's got 44 million people, which is a large chunk of people. I mean, there's different forces at play. I mean, there's also, you know, wealthy people in Europe that would like to, the carpetbaggers to go in and pick up cheap properties in Ukraine and the factories and so forth. But I'll tell you one more tidbit before I go here. On the square there in Kiev, my wife was upset because some of the cobblestone there goes back to the 16th century.
Sure.
Where they were tearing that up and throwing it at the cops. But, it's still too early to know what's going to happen. I mean,
they've been grappling with this same situation. This goes back to the Orange Revolution.
Oh, yeah, it goes. Well,
and I'm
right.
Sure,
and when you think about it, you had a country that was under the grip of communism for over 70 years, where it was a planned, controlled economy. You know, we can argue the merits of that, but then all of a sudden that whole system falls apart, and there's so much chaos in the aftermath of that. You know, and then the supposed experts arrive from the United States, tell them how they set up their new economy, like we're doing so well here ourselves.
Well, right, which basically just means, you know, we'll give you structured loans if you, you know, cut entitlements and open up your factories to Western investment. I mean, it's the same story played out all over the place. I can understand why some people, and, you know, even though it's been over 20 years since the fall of the Soviet Union, look to that as being stability, because even if it was a meager existence, it was a guaranteed existence.
Well, you know, my wife lived under it for about the first 18 years of her life, and of course, Ukraine was a little bit better off than, say, parts of Siberia, or like East Germany was pretty well off. I mean, compared to other parts.
Sure.
And, you know, she considers herself a socialist because even under the communist system, her parents had guaranteed vacations.
Right.
They had free medical care. They had free university education if you made the grade.
Right. Well, and it's an issue of when you have capitalism isn't necessarily a bad thing, but when capitalism is not controlled in any way, you get essentially a mafia style, you know,
well, right,
oligarchy situation. I mean, and I think Russia really proved that. And, you know, to bring that back into, you know, line with some level of, I guess, structure, you know, means that the Russian government has to become, you know, dictatorial. I mean, I'm.
Well, that's what I heard. That's what supposedly Putin is. You know, Putin is talking about basically what you were talking about earlier, that a lot of this has been engineered by the so-called West through NGOs and through other levers. And supposedly he's looking at what's going on in Ukraine, that it might be transported to Russia.
Right.
That it's not just an uprising. It's not just a throwing out the, you know, rotten guys, but it's actually a overthrowing of a legitimate government.
Right.
So supposedly the election was monitored by the UN, and they said it was a fair election. Of course, my wife said that's a bunch of hogwash. So,
you know, and who, as far as that, the details, I don't fully understand. But if it might be considered to be an unfair election if the people that you get a vote for aren't the people that you wanted on the ballot in the first place.
Well, no, one good thing about what happened, the best thing to happen was that the Ukrainian military generals told their troops to stand down. So they were not involved in any of the shootings you saw. That was just some internal security force.
Right. Well, you get a sense, you can find plenty of information on the internet that says that every single one of these color revolutions and all the Arab Spring and every, you know, opposition to, you know, power that we've seen in these developing and, you know, in these countries has been just manipulated. And there's all kinds of these NGOs, and I mean, what I keep seeing in regards to the Ukraine, there's a Serbian organization called Canvas. And Canvas is an acronym. I don't have the acronym in front of me right now. But essentially, they helped bring down Slobodan Milosevic in 2000. And this is, you know, they were in Tahrir Square in 2011. And they're in Kiev right now today. And this is their business. This is what they do.
Yeah, well, it's nothing, you know. You were talking about the birthday cake for the kid named Adolf. And I'll circle back around to Adolf Hitler because in Mein Kampf and in the second book he wrote, he talks easily about that, about manipulating political parties. Of course, I'm not saying he's the only one that did it, obviously, but you know, divide and conquer, those kind of things. So yeah, there's no doubt that Western influences have been involved in trying to tip Ukraine into the European orbit.
Right.
But I mean, the bottom line is, unfortunately for Ukraine, I think a lot of people there would like to be just independent.
Yeah, it's not going to happen though for them. I was doing a little, I was doing research into the history of Ukraine. They've only been independent since the fall of the Soviet Union.
Right.
And I mean, and to say that's independence is not really true. I mean, it's a very tacit independence, and it's really been under a lot of pressure for over 10 years now.
That's
a fascinating story that just, you know, I mean, won't go away. And the outcome of it seems to be the foreign policy of the United States versus the foreign policy of the Soviet Union or Russia, or, you know, here we are.
Well, you could make it the argument that's what the military industrial complex needs here.
What, another enemy?
Well, exactly.
I think we have plenty of enemies. It has, in my humble opinion, it has everything to do with Central Asian natural resource and who is going to be responsible for bringing that to market. Is that going to go to market denominated in dollars, or will it go to market denominated in a BRIC currency, you know, or the ruble, or some sort of, you know, Chinese basket currency? I mean, that's really the foreign policy, you know, concern of the United States and the other emerging powers of the planet. How are we going to denominate our fossil fuels?
Yeah, well, that's a question I guess we'll have to ponder. Anyways, I'll talk to you guys later.
All right, take care, Russ. Such a simple concept. I mean, it truly is. 816-931-5534, 931-KKFI.
I couldn't find what Canvas stands for.
Oh, really?
They kept bringing me up to Project Canvas, which was some British shoe drive.
No.
I don't think that's what you guys were talking about.
Serbian NGO Canvas. Yeah, here it is. You just got to know what to look for, dog. 816-931-5534. It's 931-KKFI. You are on the radio.
Hello, yes. Good evening. I want to give a shout-out to my homeboys, if I may.
I guess so. Are they in prison, your homeboys?
Or are they in politics?
No, they're actually driving in a car down Main Street right now.
All right, very well.
About this thing in the Ukraine, you had a couple, we see that a couple fascist groups actually joined together and overthrow the capital there. And the security guards that we saw getting beat up all week are now trying to get out of the country. And I'm not for sure if Putin himself is quite interested in making deals with a fascist state. They burned down the trade union hall, and it's kind of like a pretty tense situation over there.
Kind of like a Germany in 1920 something.
Well, I don't know if we could actually go back to 36, but. We've seen France deport gypsies. Italy is already a fascist state, even though they got rid of Berlusconi. So we're already seeing deportation of out of Europe. The anti-Muslim sentiment in Germany, there in the colleges, there's separate entrances.
Europe.
For Muslims. So I think we seem to think that Europe is a little bit more liberal than us. It's just Europe does a better job criticizing America's racism and overlooks their own.
You know, that's a good point. I mean, you know, you get a sense, you talk to Europeans who want to judge America and say, oh, in Europe we're very peaceful, and in Europe we know how to cooperate, and in Europe we know how to share power. And it's like, well, guys, you kind of had to go through 2,000 years of killing each other before you got there, and the 20th century was really rough on you. I mean, you destroyed the entire continent twice trying to share that power.
Iron out the bugs.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's kind of hollow a little bit, but you see fascism throughout Europe. You see fascism in France. You see fascism in Germany. You see fascism in Greece. It's all over the place. I mean, that's a very good point, because we have this illusion that after the defeat of Nazi Germany and imperialist Japan and, you know, fascist Italy, that fascism was somehow defeated, but it wasn't. Fascism had never went away. You know, fascism continued to be the balance of power to communism in the world, on the global stage. It's just we ended up becoming the fascist side.
Yeah, Mussolini said fascism is just the corporations running the state.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. And here we are, right? I mean, look around. I mean, there's the idea that, you know, in America, even the Supreme Court agrees that corporations have more of a political voice than individual people do, because it's a matter of free speech being denominated in dollars, not being denominated in the concept of, you know, inalienable civil liberty.
Yeah, I mean, look at the Koch brothers. I mean, Daddy Koch, you know, he worked for Stalin drilling over there. Came back and started the John Birch Society, and now he runs Kansas.
I think he runs a lot more than Kansas.
He runs a lot more than Kansas. What is he, like, maybe the fourth richest man? Fourth richest family?
I'm not sure. I don't know how they fall on that scale, but I know that they got billions, and they do very well for themselves, and they exert all kinds of influence over, you know, government. I mean, that's pretty clear, and that's the argument that was made by, you said, Mussolini and a lot of other people, that this is essentially what fascism is.
Well, it's, you know, we had a little show of it here at the courthouse this past November, where we had the stormtroopers dressed up and they had their flags, and it was quite an afternoon.
Right.
And most of those guys were from out of Texas. I think there's some from Illinois, some from Iowa. Pastor Drew.
Right. But see, that's the whole point, though, is that most fascists in America, you know, are on Wall Street. They're not, you know, they're not in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, or on the courthouse steps in Kansas City, you know, protesting, you know, trying to get somebody to listen to their Mein Kampf, their struggle or whatever. I mean, fascism in America, you know, we're talking about people who are considered to be respected, you know, leaders of captains of industry, et cetera, you know, members of the business community, you know, folks that sit in chambers of commerce, that kind of thing.
As of September 2013, according to Forbes, the Koch brothers are number 30. They're the 31st richest people on the planet at $36 billion is what they're worth. And they're still only in 31st place. 30 people.
Well, now the Keystone XL pipeline, they stand to make about $100 billion on that in the next 4 years.
Yeah, I don't know what the projections are on that, but you know, I'm sure they're going to do very well for themselves. You see their name, the Koch Industries, you know, is ever present within the petroleum world.
Well, this American Legislative Exchange Commission,
right?
They fund a lot of money behind. They've been front-loading this legislation since the 1970s.
Sure.
And,
no, absolutely. And the
we're seeing prison gangs down in, literally chain gangs in Louisiana, where they're back to hiking down the roads with shovels and spades and picks to fix roads again. And the prison labor situation is growing, and
there's a lot of things taking place in America as you know the middle class evaporates, and you know we don't have an industrial base whatsoever anymore. I mean, you know, we are still making children, we are still adding people into a workforce that continues to shrink, you know, in overall quality of job and pay every single month of every single year. I mean, at some point, something's got to give. We're going to have to start incarcerating more people, or we're going to have to start aborting more people. I mean, there's two ways we can go about doing things. I mean, some of those nice, you know, Christian billionaires from Kansas should do something good for, you know, the people of this good country and give the opportunity for, you know, fetuses to not be aborted and grow up and be members of the middle class.
Well, you know, it's interesting is because you know, America's got the highway system. It's got, you know, shopping malls at every exit. And it still appears that rich people like to live in America. And at a certain point, it's in their best interest to not live in a little walled villa like maybe in Nicaragua. And at what point are they going to wake up and realize this? I mean, we have some one percenters that like to visit Kansas City when they turn the lights on and things once a year. And
you got to realize, my friend, Kansas City has plenty of money. There's lots of one percenters that live in this town. And where do you live? Where is your part of this city?
Well, I'm north of the river.
Right. Because you go. That walled community that we're talking about of people insulated from the reality of what has been created with the form of unbridled capitalism practiced in America over the last, you know, 50, 60 years since the end of World War II. I mean, those walled communities do exist in this town. I mean, they, you know, might not have the visible walls that you see in those places like, you know, Honduras or Nicaragua or, you know, in actual third world countries where you have a cinder blocked, you know, gate around something that seems like paradise on the inside. But you go to places like Mission Hills, You know, places like Leawood, I mean, those folks are incredibly insulated, and their law enforcement is there to ensure that they remain insulated from the forces of reality that might be just a few miles to the east. I mean, that is true. That is absolutely true.
Yeah, and you can get pulled over for driving while brown over in Johnson County. I hear that quite a bit from
you
friends.
Get pulled over for just about anything.
Driving a Buick.
Yeah, driving a Buick. Yeah, not even driving while B is right, but driving while, you know, in a Buick over there. I mean, that's the case, though. I mean, people are already incredibly insulated in this country, and I think that will only continue. We'll see those disparities grow and grow and grow because, you know, for all that we hear about how poor Detroit is, I mean, remember, there's still a lot of money in Michigan. There's still a lot of money in the suburbs of Detroit. I mean, as poor as the east side of Kansas City is, Mission Hills is just a few short miles to the west. And that's the truth. And I mean, as those disparities grow, I would imagine the obstacles separating the people who have and the people that have not will continue to grow as well. And, you know, maybe people will finally realize it. But you look at a place like Ukraine, because all that's going on over there, I'm sure, has an economic root. I mean, as most things do. In America, we're not hungry enough to demand a change in the streets or whatever. I mean, if that's how you want to look what they're doing in the Ukraine, you can look at it as being, you know, people are demanding a change because they're hungry and they don't see a future. Or it's just a completely and totally orchestrated event by a bunch of NGOs and State Department money. Okay, fine. But if we want to just take them at face value, you could say, in America, we're not gonna march. We're not going to demand some sort of change with this economic paradigm because we got food stamps and we have, you know, extra value menus.
And a whole season of House of Cards to watch.
Right, and we have, you know, our bellies aren't empty. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. I mean, the separation between rich and poor has never been a wider gap. Yet, you know, during the Victorian period, a lot of the social conscious groups came out of that. You know, continued into the 20th century, and so I think the disparity there is with the poor, that they don't think that the middle class actually has, you know, any concern about their strife and their struggle, and it isn't always quite seen that immediately for them.
I mean, I could be wrong, but you said that you know, there's never been such a gap. I mean, I would say that probably at the turn of the last century there had to have been. I mean, there was the guys, the captains of industry that walked around dressed like you know, the Monopoly Man, and then there was the industrial workers. You know, there's no middle class, really. I mean, the middle class is what? It's just poor people with credit cards.
But you go back to that time you're talking about in the 19th century. That was before the majority of America lived in cities. That's when the majority of America still lived in the country, working the land, generating their own wealth. I mean, you know, the idea of making your own money. If you're a farmer, I mean, you literally turn your work and sunshine into money. You know, now people are dependent, either generally speaking. I mean, there's a lot of people that make their own money, generate their own money today, you know, going on small businesses and, you know, contractors, entrepreneurs, et cetera. But so many of us are dependent upon corporations or the government for our money, for our check, you know, have struggle making our own money out there in the economy. And that's just one of the things that have changed where, sure, you know, there is always the corruption. There's always been these problems, but it's just they've become so much more effective, you know, as of late. You know, the Koch brothers existed, you know, 150 years ago. It's just now they have, you know, their abilities, their power is much more coalesced and streamlined.
Yeah, because now they're in the eyes of the court, they're a person, and the top tax rate is no longer 90%.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, if you go back, you know, the 19th century, just starving the Sioux Indians for the Black Hills gold. I mean, the wealth that come out of the Black Hills alone during Ulysses S. Grant time makes him the most crooked president that ever lived.
Right. Well, I don't know a whole bunch about that, but I mean, certainly this corrupt, there's not this gilded age, this great time of American democracy or information. I mean, you can look back and try to find some great golden era, but in reality, there wasn't one. I mean, we have always struggled with the nature of man as human beings, not just in America, but throughout, you know, history. The opportunities for us to create something better are here, but it seems as though now, even though we have all these tools and all these all this information in front of us, and we still struggle to put it together, because now more than ever, it seems like there are distractions everywhere. And one of the bigger ones is that if you are providing for a family and you're trying to make it in today's world, there's so much more expected of you than there was just a few generations ago. I mean, the amount of time that people have to work to be able to survive has increased. And that puts pressures on the kind of the more, less pragmatic aspects of life and more kind of idealistic, you know, which, can you participate within your, you know, neighborhood? Can you participate within your local political structures to, you know, make sure that your community will be a better place? I mean, it's hard to do that when you're working several jobs and you're stressed out about your bills and wondering how you're going to be able to pay the mortgage, the car payment, et cetera.
And the environmental factors, of the degradation of the land, the air, and the water. I mean, there's a lot of respiratory illness. I mean, by the time a person's 40 years old now, they're already developing illnesses that are going to kill them in the next 30 years. Just read the obituaries in the paper. You're always seeing men 55 years old. You know, it's only, you'll see a couple kids that die in car wrecks. You'll see granny who lives to be 95 years old. But you always see men in their mid-50s are already dying. And why is that? That's from stress.
Oh, no, stress is a huge one. And, I mean, the fact that we are so incredibly, you know, spread thin and forced to, endure a lot of struggle that I'm sure folks a couple generations ago would be like, folks in the future won't have to deal with this, won't have to, you know, have these concerns, because technology and, you know, science and, you know, just general education will make our existence easier. But we're backsliding from that. We're you know, life is becoming more difficult for people. You know, the generations that are coming are not going to be as well off as their parents' generation, et cetera. And that's where we're at.
We're not as well off as our parents.
Well, no, I've heard this. I've heard this for 20 years. This, the next generation is not going to, you know, is not, you know, it was the same time when this neoliberal model was coming in, it started with Pinochet, you know, and, you know, we've seen 50 dictators, you know, overthrown and strong men put in, and any time there's an economic model that doesn't work, the United States can just send in the Marines, and that's what we've seen time after time. And we're at the point now where Kandahar in Afghanistan is the far remote area of the empire, and we've lost it. We're in retreat, just like the Romans retreating from Scotland. And I hate to use that model, because that's what Granddad talks about, is the United States being like Rome. But Rome's golden age only lasted 70 years. We got about 5 years out of our golden age between 47 and the beginning of the Korean War or the Cold War. That's where our big chunk. I mean, yeah, we got a lot of technology out of the Cold War because we were pushed by the Russians with the space race. But the cost in nuclear power. I mean, we see peace planners and everybody out here at the Honeywell plant, I mean, we see people just all kinds of cancers and things just out of that Honeywell plant. You know, that's the second one they've built. And the cost of nuclear technology alone, we're not even addressing those issues.
Well, I mean, you know, and the true cost of nuclear technology is like the story out of New Mexico last week. From Carlsbad, New Mexico, where they have, you know, a large storage facility of nuclear waste in an old salt mine, and it's leaking. I mean, that's the true cost of that nuclear technology, is the, you know, environmental pollution of it all. And the fact that we're dealing with extremely fallible human beings who are in charge of making sure that it's safe for the next 25,000 years or something. I mean, it's just, give me a break. I mean, right. When it comes down to it, you got to choose something other than fear in this world. And I mean, that's been the policy. I mean, the end of the of World War II, just like the end of the Cold War, there was an opportunity for people to choose something other than fear to live their lives. But unfortunately, those two milestone events, the end of World War II, the end of the Cold War, where there was an opportunity for, you know, people in America, human beings, to take a different direction, you know, we have not. We have continued to be afraid, scared.
Well, and the distraction was with consumerism, where we gave up being citizens, and we traded in for being consumers.
Well, that's the bread and circus thing, right? That's the, if you want to draw again parallels to the Roman Empire. I mean, it's, you know, nobody was paying attention to the political reality of the collapse of the Roman Empire because they had entertainment and their bellies were full. I mean, we're right there. There's no difference. I mean, America, we should truly be outraged by what's taking place, what's going on in our country, and some of us are, but to coalesce some real change where you have people who are motivated, willing to sacrifice, is hard to do because people do not want to give up their bread and their circus for that revolution, that time. And I, you know,
we are seeing progress from in a progressive sense, even in Kansas City, at some level, I think here, because for one, they didn't get a new football stadium. Okay,
but they still spent $300 million.
They're not getting a pro hockey team. Right. It's questionable if this airport is bread and circus, because what is the function of a tearing down that airport, and you know, where they could just fix a few leaky pipes or whatever superficial issues they have with that airport now.
Well, the issue with the airport, you know, obviously the mayor would like to be able to put his name on something and say, I built this, and I didn't have to raise the citizens of Kansas City's tax dollars to do so. But, you know, they really want to have a more, you know, terror-proof airport. I mean, that's a lot of what this is truly about. The ease and, you know, accessibility that KCI currently has, you know, does not yield to the most terror-proof, you know, secure airport possible. I mean, so it's a matter of fear is one of the big components. And anyone that is truly in support of building a new airport is probably going to tell you they have terrorism as the number one.
Be scared.
Yeah. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
You're not going to be able to get there 10 minutes before your flight and make it.
Yeah. So the quicker you can move through, the safer you are. Is that the idea?
No, right now you can literally, Kansas City is the only airport I've ever been to where you can get there 10 minutes before they stop boarding a plane and still make it just fine. Park, check your bags, go through. It's a very easy airport. We have a very lucky airport here.
Absolutely. But my friend.
So, you know, during the Cold War, you know, Northern Ireland had the most secure airport when they were fighting the IRA. And they seem to manage to operate that airport, you know, pretty well for decades, until the war on terror and the IRA stood down. And, you know, we don't see any type of security that you'd see like they had in the Cold War on this war of terror. And you know, yeah, you're right. It's easy to get in and out of this airport, and the actual cost. And we were talking about the fall of Rome, where the infrastructure crumbled because they had three wars with Carthage, and no. We've been at war almost What?
It was
at least 20 years straight now.
It was the political infrastructure of Rome. The physical infrastructure of Rome, a lot of that still stands to this day. But, I mean, you know, it's...
Well, no, it rotted. It rotted. I mean, it can be defended that Rome burned because the rats took over, literally. Right. Because the aqueducts, all that stuff, was no longer maintained because they'd gone to war. By the Second Punic War, they should have stopped. But they continued. Rome went to war just for the sake of going to war. And this is what we're seeing now. Where when the Cold War ended, we had to have a new enemy, and we created one. The United States, in Afghanistan. I mean, you go back and look at the story of Charlie Wilson's war, when they built that one bridge, you know, and it just opened up that whole region.
And I mean, a lot of some people think that we are continuing to invest in future conflicts, and we're doing that in Pakistan, we're doing that in Sudan, we're doing that in Somalia, we're doing that in maybe the Ukraine, and that is to continue the perpetual war machine that has been the American economy since the end of World War II. But my friends, I will leave it there. I appreciate your phone call. Nice talking with you. Have a good morning.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye. It's about 10 minutes before the top of the hour, and I'm going to go get some coffee. This is the Paragon Radio Program. I'm Benjamin, your host.
Chica. Whatcha. Baby, baby, time to waste. If you're a fooling, I'm a fading. I'm advocating a mutual praising, a face to face. Got paid, beer drinker got played, sunglasses on the blackbird, barbecue is the new word, sleeping bag ain't no good, when you're lost in the hood, it's that West Texas dust. Get it on now.
5 minutes before the top of the hour when it will be 2 o'clock right here in Kansas City, and you are listening to Community Radio. All right, so a lot of folks are talking about what's going on in the Ukraine or in Ukraine right now, but it's not the only dire situation taking place. Apparently, Venezuela is having a lot of issues right now as well. Venezuela's had a lot of problems. What's going on? It's been a while. So when was the last time Venezuela was just good? Huh? Back when they were just, you know, following the instructions of Washington? You know, when everything was peaceful in Venezuela?
1997, right?
Before Mr. Chavez started his Bolivarian revolution. But back when Venezuela just had poor people and really rich people. And the really rich people sold the oil and ran the government and controlled the media. And the poor people, you know, they just, you know, barely existed. Just made babies and starved. You know, back when everything was stable down there in Venezuela. Then you had the Bolivarian Revolution, a little democracy, the unintended consequences of democracy. You know, you remember when Hamas was elected the leaders of the Palestinian peoples of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and the State Department of the United States under the direction of Condoleezza Rice had to say, sometimes when you have democracy, you get, I don't know, unintended consequences. We didn't really want that to happen, but it did happen. But, you know, since Chavez died, his successor, Nicolas Maduro, has had a lot of problems. Doesn't seem to have the ability to keep everything together over there the way, Hugo did. And I don't know. It's hard to defend, you know, the Chavez mentality in Venezuela. I mean, it really just kind of comes down to its opposition to the influence of Washington and the, you know, elites of Venezuela, because Venezuela has a lot of money because they have a lot of oil. And there has been a very large contingent of people in control, like there is throughout Central and South America, you know, of the resources, of the wealth, of the political structure, of the power. I mean, it's something we talk about in America, how, you know, there are so many haves and, you know, their influence over everything, which is real in this country, but it's really nothing compared to the way it can be down in South and Central America. These disparities of wealth, these disparities of political power are so much more, you know, the chasms are so much greater in these places. But now they're saying the current violent actions taking place in Venezuela are, you know, to some a troubling reminder of the events back in April of 2002, which turned out to be an attempted coup against then President Hugo Chavez. Similar protests organized in 2002 by the right-wing political factions in Venezuela caused a number of fatalities, while the oligarchy, along with private media and radical opposition, broke constitutional order and imposed a dictatorship that lasted just 48 hours, you know, thanks to the mobilization of the people. No Venezuelan government has done as much for the young people as Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro in terms of education, health, access to culture, and regulation. And since 1998, the right wing has refused to accept the people's will and being unable to take power democratically, it opts for violence. And, you know, according to people that know, the United States plays a key role in this attempt to destabilize Venezuela today, stressing that this country is the world's fifth largest oil producer, and that since the Chavez regime assumed power, he has achieved some level of economic, political, and energy sovereignty for the country, but it has come at a great cost. I mean, for the people of Venezuela, this has not been an easy road. But it's a conflict. Like, what do you do? Do you continue on with the, you know, the IMF and the World Bank structured loans and, you know, noose around the neck of your economy that, you know, has to subsidize the poor because of the, you know, economic situation there, the inequality of money and the haves and the have-nots? I mean, just some of the information that is coming out about that is getting completely ignored because of everything else that is taking place. You know, it's like
their internet was shut down, so that doesn't help.
Right, and it does not help. And I'm pretty sure that the president said he was going to shut down one of the major TV stations as well because the media in Venezuela is controlled by the powerful, wealthy families and not necessarily, you know, the government's regime, but they have to, they are becoming